Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic, Sean Patrick. Visit us at ihatecritics.net, everyonesacriticpodcast.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is criticspod. And listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Alexa, YouTube, Ghana, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, leave a comment on YouTube. I like to look at those every now and then. We got a couple of nice ones. I should pull them up and read them, but I'm not ready for that. I don't know if you've looked at our top YouTube videos lately, but it's different than it was.
Really?
Yeah, Silent Sex or Quiet Sex has dropped quite a bit, or just dropped to number 3.
Wow, that'd have been our top episode. It was, of course, our Quiet Place episode where we pondered the notion of how they were able to have sex so quietly in this situation.
Yeah.
A reasonable question, if you ask me.
Our number one episode is Willem Dafoe's Confusingly Large Penis. let's see what our number two was. That was pretty funny, too, if I remember right. They actually, we did have a comment saying that episode was fantastic, the Willem Dafoe one.
Nice.
Videos sort by most downloaded. Oh, number two, The Incest Was Weird. We talked about that. I don't remember what movie that was.
All right, let me wait. Which movie was that?
I know that Climax is the art I used that week, but I don't remember what other movie we talked about that week. Maybe it was a throwaway comment that was made. I don't know. Number five is Josh Sings Dan Fogelberg. So I don't know.
Maybe we've discovered this little rabbit hole of the internet where Dan Fogelberg is a big hero. People just don't know it. Like when in my writing, I found that when I look at my numbers, if you write something about Keanu Reeves, people go crazy for it. Just I mean, I know there's a lot of Keanu Reeves fans, and that's not all that surprising. It would be surprising if Dan Fogelberg were that popular, but not him. But I was a little bit surprised just to see it. I could write anything about Keanu Reeves, and it's just huge. It's a wonder that I have absolutely no, you know, capability towards capitalism that I don't just start writing a series of articles about Keanu Reeves. But nevertheless, it's proven extraordinarily popular no matter what I write about him.
Yeah, but you can feel dead inside if you don't mean it. I've been there.
It's true.
You've all heard my Adam Lambert stories. Maybe you haven't, but I'm not telling them again. Anyway, he had a message board, and his fans did not like me, and I never said anything bad about him either. It was weird. I actually like him quite a bit. I just don't like him enough, apparently. Let's see.
Oh, like me and Mad Max.
Right. What am I forgetting? Patreon. Patreon.com/CriticsPod is the best way to help support the podcast. And also our TeePublic page at ihatecritics.net. There's a little TeePublic thing up in the corner. Or you can go to TeePublic and search CriticsPod if you want some of our merch. Let's just jump right into the episode. It's going to be not necessarily a short one, but less movies than normal because a pandemic and... Quite frankly, I spent way too much time watching election coverage. I don't know how I got to all these movies. but regardless, let's start with Fishbowl.
Fishbowl, yes. Fishbowl is a movie starring a guy named Rick Kane as Rick. He's the father to three daughters and is grieving the death of his wife. Rick holds a particular secret from his daughters related to the death of their mother, and to me, wasn't a big secret to us. I kind of had an idea of what it was that he's holding back, but perhaps he hasn't told them or they haven't been able to figure it out. They haven't heard it from others. Regardless, this loss has devastated this family to an enormous degree. Strangely, it's also destroyed them within their small town, I guess, because most of the town must know what took place and how it happened. And they've decided to shun not just the father, but also these three girls who are kind of no longer spoken to by friends at school. And they appear to not really know why. The oldest probably just doesn't care. She's, you know, she's kind of throwing herself into a whole new crowd of friends anyway. The story progresses that the father falls into this sort of doomsday cult. He doesn't have a job. He's, I don't know what exactly he's living off of, but he spends his days watching this doomsday preacher tell him about this plan that it basically amounts to a doomsday pyramid scheme where you're trying to sign up other people to enter the apocalypse with you. And if you get this many people, you'll have a nicer place once the world comes to an end. And it is as pathetic as it sounds. And this actor, Rick Kane, really adds a level of just how pathetic this truly is. He's a sad character and yet a very intense and hard to look at character. You just kind of want to avert your gaze when he's on screen. He's so intense at all times and yet so pathetic as well. He's rumpled and kind of slow moving, and you want, there's a part of you that pities him, but at the same time, when he turns his eyes to you, he kind of looks like a serial killer. So there's two sides to him. I find this actor Rick Kane to be a fascinating guy, and because of him, I really found this whole movie incredibly fascinating, and really was kind of hooked by it throughout. They really buy into the notion of the end of the world, and they keep painting this guy not necessarily as a prophet, but certainly as a guy who deeply believes in the end of the world, and it builds towards an ending that is very. I guess the directors are really fair to this idea that maybe perhaps the world is ending. it's fascinating to watch the way it plays out, the way he. You know, the way he tries to control his family. I found this film to be masterfully directed by a directorial duo by the name of Stephen and Alexa Kinigopoulos did an amazing job directing this. I really found Fishbowl to be incredibly fascinating, and I can't say enough good things about it.
It's another one of those where I wish I could have saw it in a theater in that atmosphere. I like this one quite a bit more than some of the other movies I said that about. But I just, you know, watching it during the day with family members around, and especially kids running in and out and their devices in the background, that's why theaters need to come back, but we got to get the coronavirus under control before we can do that. And I can just imagine how it would have, I don't know what the word I'm trying to, just engulfed me, I guess. Just lost in the movie.
Engrossing was right there. That was the exact word you needed.
Right. And, you know, just getting lost in the movie. And I was pretty close a couple of different times. It was just, you're always getting pulled in and out when you're at home with kids. But it was just fascinating. I liked it quite a bit. I didn't always know. It was... At no point are you going, well, I wouldn't do that, or you're not even thinking like that, because this movie, you know, engrosses you so much. I'll just keep using that word over and over again now. But that's, you know, a lesser movie would have you going, well, I wouldn't do that, or these girls, why are they acting like that? Just leave them. Or, you know, there's at no point are you thinking these things. You're just wondering. You're trying to get in their head. It's such a fascinating movie. It is very well directed. I like it quite a bit. I want to say it's probably a top 10 for me right now. I don't know. I mean, it's been some of the movies you liked a little more. I didn't like as much because I really got taken out by having kids in my house. But I don't know. I like it a lot. I think it's really well made. And I don't know if it's just from the lack of movies I've seen this year or not. But it was just fascinating. I loved the ending.
The idea here that you're taking the actual like potential end of the world and using that as a metaphor to tell a story about a family dealing with grief and loss of the single most important person in all of their lives. The mother, Macy, is a character. Judith Hogue plays her. She's seen only in flashbacks and but you can sense like the entirety of the movie changes whenever she's on screen. You know, suddenly the sun is shining, and you'll notice that when you're watching it, the rest of the movie, you do see the sun, but it's very muted. And then it changes when she's on screen. And some of that is just the nature of a dream sequence or a nature of a flashback, but also it's intentional to just show you how much warmer and brighter the world was when Macy was there. And that's a really lovely visual touch. And that's really what these two directors do, is they control the tone and the pace and the tension and the atmosphere, especially, of this story throughout. This is a very well-controlled movie. They know how to sort of suck the air out of the room when they need to. And that is really exciting. And they do that a couple of times in this movie where they pull the air right out of the room and you're just, what's happening? I love that. I love that.
Yeah, and it's available to rent now, and I definitely recommend checking it out. It's quite the experience. It's not for everybody, I guess. It's not a straight-ahead movie. It's just a really well-done art piece, and, you know, and as far as I'm concerned. When I put it on, my wife's like, fishbowl, really? Thinking I was putting some swinger movie on or something like that. And I was like, no, just give it a chance. Sean told me to watch it. It's really good. And I don't think he would. Maybe he would tell me to do that just for him to be funny. But no, it was a, I don't know, just I like it quite a bit. And
yet another movie we likely would never have heard about. It would have slipped right through, perhaps, if it hadn't been for this situation.
Yeah, it would have to be we happened to luckily get some art house movie that popped in every now and then. I don't know what this one would have, but movies like this have, but not often. And it's kind of luck of the draw. But being that it's not from like Neon or A24 or whatever, those usually don't get that weird art house release.
And it doesn't have any stars, you know. The directors are first time directors, so there's nothing there that's going to pop theatrically. So it's again, like I said, it's one of those that probably would have slipped through the cracks. And you know, it got a lot of festival notice early on, but that festival notice was kind of last year. Yeah. And so the idea that it would have stuck around without this is kind of And then again, I'm not crediting the coronavirus for making this a better year for movies. I'm just saying it's the truth. We wouldn't likely have seen this movie or in a number of them this year. H's for Happiness would not have happened this year without the situation.
And part of the problem I have with the atmosphere is that I still haven't fixed my TV from my son broke it. So I'm watching it in the living room where I can still hear their room. I can't get down in the basement, turn the lights off, and lock the doors and get away. So maybe I just need to buy a TV and be done with it. But I don't know. I need to do something though, because it is not fair to movies. Anything else on Fishbowl before we move on?
Yeah, I guess, like you said, it's available on many of, if not all, the streaming rental services, and a must see, I feel.
The next two movies are available on Shudder. Let's start with La Llorona.
La Llorona, not to be confused with The Curse of La Llorona, which was a terrible horror movie that came out in 2019. The taking off on the South American legend of the Weeping Woman, which is the Weeping Woman is La Llorona. The idea behind the Weeping Woman is that it's a grief so powerful that it creates an entity that comes to life and seeks revenge on the thing that created the grief. And that is a great idea for a horror movie. And the fact that other filmmakers have taken La Llorona and used it for just another monster movie is just stupid. And that's why I really did enjoy this movie, because it takes the notion of La Llorona, this character of this monstrous grief that has to, you know, has to take vengeance upon the thing that caused it. I really liked that aspect of it. So the idea here is that we're in, I think it's a fictional, for the most part, South American country. We are inside the compound of a general who's been the dictator of this country for a number of years. His crimes have now started to come to light, in which he committed a horrific genocide on a group of people, on a large portion of the population that lived in the mountains. And the people are starting to rise up. They would like him prosecuted. He is prosecuted at one point, but whether or not he's going to stay on or even, you know, just escape this prosecution, you'll need to see the movie. But there's this element throughout of these, of this intimations of exactly the horrors that he committed, and how one of those horrors has essentially become La Llorona, the weeping woman, and is going and has begun to affect his life and his family's life. And I thought this movie had, there's elements of it that are very predictable. There are elements of it that are very familiar. It's not a standout fantastic horror movie, but at the very least, I appreciated that they take this premise, which I think is a really good one, and they give it weight and seriousness, and they play it out in a way that makes sense. And I appreciated that, especially considering what the Americanized The Curse of La Llorona did, which was just absolutely shitty.
It's a very contained movie, which is what I like about it. When we watch some of these classic movies, and we're just like, the story makes sense. Why don't they do that today? This is a movie that makes sense. They don't have to throw all the bells and whistles at it to make it good. And because of that, you just get a nice, tight little story that is more well done than most movies, most especially horror movies today. You mentioned The Curse of La Llorona, where it's just too much going on. There's no real rhyme or reason. Then they try to back their way into a backstory. And this one, this guy's haunted, and at the end they show you what he did. They're kind of showing you throughout, and I like that. There's no twist. It's just very straight ahead. It's contained. It's more effective this way. In some ways, that prevents it from being, you know, kind of like a standout, I guess. But it's better than being shitty. And yeah. I was just really impressed with the movie all around. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. It's hard to, I don't know that I would have seen it even on the better week. The fact that we didn't have many movies helped this week. But I'm glad I did. It was a good, tight little movie that makes me appreciate the way they did things. And I wish more filmmakers were capable of telling movies like this that are contained, and you don't have to go over the top to make it better. You just tell the story as it is, and it's going to be tight and good.
And I love the perspective, too, of taking us inside. Immediately, we're inside the compound. We're immediately in the presence of the dictator. Mm-hmm. And he's automatically a bad guy just from being a dictator. And we're from his perspective throughout. And immediately, we see him as this sort of pathetic figure, because the minute you see a dictator out of his uniform and, you know, like wearing a tank top and pajama pants, suddenly he's not scary. He's not the massive military dictator. He's just this old man who's, you know, slowly dying and rotting on the inside, and he's not scary. And the things he did were horrific, but it reveals him to be so very, very human in his evil. And that is, again, another smart aspect of this movie, is putting us in that perspective and kind of putting us on the side of La Llorona, because La Llorona is absolutely right to go after this fucker. Oh, he's evil. And that's the thing. It's not like they make him like really shitty, like you're one of those characters where you're kind of hoping that the evil thing gets them. The Weeping Woman was never evil. She was created by evil. And that's the thing that this movie recognizes, whereas the Curse of La Llorona and other similar movies that use this type of demonic character or demon-like character, they make that thing the evil thing, and then they create characters who are either mildly sympathetic, boring, or not sympathetic at all. And they also give us a couple of sides here, because his wife, maybe she's aware of what he did, maybe she's not, but they certainly torture her quite well and quite effectively, intimating that maybe she did know. Then he's got a daughter who's a doctor, and her daughter who really weren't aware fully of the kind of evil that their father and grandfather was capable of, and that creates, you know, a group of characters that you can kind of be on the side of while you're also a little bit scared of what Law You're Running might do.
Yeah, and the fact that it's on Shudder is weird to me. I mean, I guess I shouldn't judge that. I've never really watched any movies on that platform before. I just kind of assumed it was a second-rate horror platform. But I was just really impressed with it. If you get a chance to see it, it is a foreign film, so you got to read. But you almost don't. You know, I almost feel like you could watch it without reading and know what's going on. But it's, I don't know, I really liked it. I liked the whole war aspect of it. You're right. The way you described The Dictator was perfect. And while you were describing it, I'm just like, I wonder what Trump looks like in pajama pants and a tank top. Probably pathetic.
Probably, yes. It's hard not to look pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I look pathetic in a tank top and pajama pants, so. But, yeah. Go, if you got nothing else to do this weekend, I definitely recommend that one as well. It's on Shudder. I think if you just go to Amazon and search it, you can rent it there through Shudder. That's how I did it, at least.
Yeah.
Anything else on that movie before we move on?
Just a solid recommendation and well done, Shudder.
I'm curious about your opinion of the next one, Host. Another Shudder movie.
Yeah, Host is a Zoom-based horror movie. believe it, is it English? Kind of sound, a couple of the characters sounded like they had English accents. I'm not sure though.
Yeah, I don't know if that actually is English or they were just from, you know, Britain and they're over here. I don't really know, but yeah, they definitely had the accents.
So a group of female friends and their one male friend are getting together on Zoom to hold a seance. Obviously this is during COVID, so they can't get together and all be in the same room together. So they're doing this via Zoom. The lead character is named Haley, and she's put this whole thing together, and she's brought all her friends into this and told them the rules. But, of course, this being a horror movie, obviously they're going to defy the rules. And when one of the characters, Gemma, decides to defy the rules by making up a fake ghost in her past, it leads to an actual real ghost who begins to start killing them. Effective. It's an effective movie. It moves, but it moves at a glacial pace for a movie that's an hour long. It felt much longer than it did. I didn't hate this. I was impressed by what they were capable of doing. And given the limitations, it did have an impressive quality there. It definitely is a movie that'll make you a little afraid of the dark at the end of the night, which is certainly a lot of fun for people. But I could have, my life goes on without seeing this. Yeah, definitely. Like,
yeah.
It's not a movie I'm going to remember past this show. Hey, well done, you know, doing something during this time and doing it in a way that is timely. Some could say even exploitative of the current moment.
Right. I mean, it's a gimmick movie, and that's, yeah, it kind of begins and ends there. It scared the shit out of my wife. I don't know why. Like, I'm sitting there just watching, and she's like, this doesn't scare you? I'm like, I go to a lot of movies. And I don't believe in this stuff. If I did, I wouldn't have all the satanic stuff in my basement that I have. But I don't know. Things that, and I'll even give Paranormal Activity a little more credit. Like that wreck, Blair Witch Project, there's a reason. You don't need to have your camera with you all the time or carry your laptop around. There's a couple scenes where they run around with their phones and their laptops when they probably wouldn't. And it works, and it helps the scares a little bit more. But as an experienced moviegoer, you're just like, come on, you know, but yeah, you're supposed to go with it. And so I did, and, you know, you get past the part, and it, like you said, it's effective and it works. But a movie like The Blair Witch Project, there's a reason they had to have the cameras on. Wreck, there's a reason they had to have the cameras on. They needed the light. Paranormal Activities are just, they're at night. So it worked. But this one, you do run into that problem with, why do you have your phone right now? Or why do you have your laptop running around your house with it? But aside from that, there was a good, I thought the scene in the attic where they did take the phone to look, I thought that was well done. But it's a gimmick jump scare movie, and like you said, because of the limitations, it's impressive on a certain level, but definitely not, you know, this isn't, we're not going to be talking about it next year or probably even next week.
No, definitely not. Nothing really memorable about this. It's clever, and I appreciate the gimmick and what they accomplished with the gimmick, and that's pretty well where it ends right there. A group of friends who want to watch a movie together on Shudder via Zoom will have a great deal of fun watching this.
I think it would play well on Netflix. I don't know why they haven't tried to get a movie like that, but I don't know. Maybe Shudder offered something. It doesn't matter. Let's move on to our classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
Marnie.
What did I say about this movie last week? That it's my favorite Sean Connery movie?
I think so.
Man. Can I switch that to something else?
Fine.
What do I like of his?
Hunt for October, the Red Bikini movie.
Untouchables. There you go. I liked Untouchables. That's it. That's all the Sean Connery for me. Marty is full of shit.
It does not hold up at all.
It really doesn't. I mean, it's well directed. It's hit. He's a master, but let's get into this bullshit story. Marnie is the lead character played by Tippi Hedren, and she is a con artist. She takes jobs at various different businesses as a bookkeeper, and she uses that opportunity to steal from them. Because back in the day, you actually had to have cash on hand in many of these places, and you know, some still do today, but many don't have to have this and with the internet as it is. But back in the day, you used to have you know, a significant amount of cash on hand, and so that it's definitely of that time. And she's able to steal nearly $10,000 just about every time she does it, and she's doing it to fund a particular lifestyle where she can keep her mother, Bernice, comfortably in a home, and especially she can keep this horse that she loves, Florian. She's finished one job. We Hitchcock does this very, very well in introducing her. We come to the aftermath of one of her many crimes, and the police are interviewing the guy, and he's telling them about who she was and how to find her, and obviously how not easy that's going to be. And we cut to a scene where she's, you know, washing the color out of her hair, and she's, you know, moving on to her next job. And it's an effective, you know, way of introducing her. The story will progress that the next job she takes is at a publishing house owned by Mr. Rutland, played by Sean Connery. And he happened to have been at the scene of the previous robbery. He'd happened to have been there because he's a client of the other company that she'd just robbed, which she wasn't aware of. And so he thinks he recognizes her, and then it turns out, obviously, yes, in fact, he did recognize her, and especially after she robs his place, he decides to go after her and find her. And you would think that this would be about, and obviously, this should be about him sending her to prison, but no. No, he immediately, within seconds, has fallen in love with her, and he's decided that he should use this information to force her to marry him. And all of this, this entire fucking movie adds up to him just pushing every button he can just to sleep with her. Just everything he can do just to make this woman sleep with him. And it's so gross. Like, when you get down to it, all of the things that you expect of a Hitchcock movie, all the suspense you think you're going to get, all of the, you know, the daring do, the exciting chase scenes or something that you're going to get. Nope. It's just, this guy really wants to bang this girl. And that's all of Marty. I was like, oh my God, how did I forget this? It's so embarrassing. This movie is terrible. It's insidious. It's disgusting in terms of its basic premise that he's everything he does, he's torturing this woman, all in the name of he's in love with her, but really he just wants to have sex with her.
Really, yeah, at what point even rapes her?
I mean, it's, you're right. There's a straight up rape scene.
And he's like the good guy. I don't. It doesn't make it any better when, I mean, obviously we watch it because he passed, and then, but as he passes, you see a bunch of celebrities writing bad things about him and all the horrible things he said about women. Hitchcock himself has a reputation with the way he treated women on set. So
he tortured Tippi Hedren on the set of this movie and ruined her career after this movie.
And you throw those two things at it, and it really makes this a hard one to watch. Like, really hard.
Really hard. And it's got this... We're going to go ahead and spoil this thing, because I don't waste your time. So the whole thing is that she suffered a trauma as a child. Her mother was a prostitute, and she's kind of repressed the memory of the fact that she was a prostitute, a sex worker. And that one of these guys who was paying her mom for sex attempted to put his hands on her, maybe, and she ended up killing him. It's played by Bruce Dern, by the way, just a kind of random note there. That scene is so bizarre and confusing because the Hays Code and the code of the time doesn't allow for us to actually see what happens. So the first rape scene we see with Connery raping Tippi Hedren, they had to shoot in a way that really heavily implied what took place, which right. They do very well by just focusing on her blank stare. And that's a very effective and horrific scene. This one is much more confusing because really when you're watching this, you're going, is Bruce Dern going to hurt this person or is he just comforting a child? Legitimately, because his demeanor doesn't necessarily come off as creepy. It comes off as, hey, little girl, I know there's a storm going on. Are you all right?
Yeah.
But then the mother comes rushing in and says, don't touch my daughter, before he's even had a chance to do anything. And all of this, of course, is not because it's all basically because of the code of the time that Hitchcock can't actually state outright what is supposed to be happening here, and there's no skillful way to make this communicate better. Maybe Bruce Dern, I guess, could have been a little bit creepier or a little bit handsier to sell that portion of it, or maybe they were just both crazy and they murdered an innocent man.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was confusing.
But then it gets into this bullshit psychology. Because again, all of this is just a ploy by Connery's character to just break her down to the point where she's willing to sleep with him. Because the big plot point throughout is that she doesn't like to be touched by men. And she doesn't even really know why it is. It's all this repressed memory, which repressed memory, by the way, is almost entirely bullshit. It's almost entirely something made up by movies, TV shows, and a couple of pieces of Freud's writing that he was never even really sure about. So repressed memory is almost entirely bullshit to begin with. But then you're using this repressed memory as a reason why she won't let men get close to her. And it also explains her criminal behavior. So she's completely, really innocent in the end because this repressed memory made her a criminal. So take that edge away from this character. But then her entire life is explained by she had this repressed memory. And then once she's able to get this memory out into the open and talk about it with her mom, well, now she's able to fuck Sean Connery. Congratulations. We've reached the climax of the movie, literally, because now they're able to fuck. That's this movie.
Terrible. Like, terrible. Really, really bad. Like, I'd rather watch a James Bond movie.
I've never hated a Hitchcock movie before. This is so sad for me.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the greatest directors are kind of shitty people, and Kubrick, Hitchcock, David O. Russell even.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm willing to watch the movies for what they were because they're some of the best movies ever made. But this one, man, when you're allowed to bring that to it, you know, some of his stories, and not to mention Connery's, it just made it even that much worse. And I don't know. I don't know what I watched, why I watched. I don't know. It was really a disappointment because this is the first time Hitchcock's really bummed me out.
Yeah, same. Same. I mean, I know you and Josh didn't love Rope as much as I do, but this is way more,
oh, yeah.
way more disappointing than that.
Well, Rope's, and it's so. I think I liked it more than Josh did.
Yeah.
It's its own little thing. It's almost a gimmick in a way. I mean, it's a stage play, essentially.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was neat, and I thought Jimmy Stewart was, I almost said Jimmy Connors. Why, I don't know. I thought Jimmy Stewart was fantastic in it, but it wasn't as, you know, in fairness, I mean, he made Vertigo. I mean, not to mention Psycho, and so you got, like, the best movies of all time, and this is a very good movie. So it's a hard bar to live up to. But I did like Rope, but this was just god awful. Like, you know, kind of like Clint Eastwood's, you know, train movie or whatever that was called.
It's really like, I mean, we're watching a man just play out his, I mean, really, we're getting a way too much of a inside of Alfred Hitchcock's brain. Like, obviously there's a reason this woman won't sleep with me. It must be that she has a repressed memory of sexual violence in her past. Clearly that's why Tippi Hedren won't fuck me.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to act this out and have Sean Connery be me. And we're going to break her down emotionally to get to the point where she'll sleep with me.
Yeah. And you know, Kubrick did that with A Clockwork Orange, and when we get to that someday, I'm just curious what my opinion is going to be that day. But yeah, it's funny. Just, I don't know.
At the same time, there's so, like, elements of this that are really strong. Like, I wrote a 1,000-word article yesterday about the symbolism of the horse Florio. And how it's used in Marnie, and that is really skillful, you know, background piece of filmmaking. The horse appears repeatedly through the movie, and it represents so many different things. And if you're, and a lot of it you have to bring it to yourself. But when you're talking about symbology in movies, the horse at first represents her one joy in the world, the one thing that she has that she feels is pure and her own, and that she owns. But it also, at the same time, represents her crimes, because she couldn't have this horse without also being this criminal. The second time the horse pops up, it's when Connery has brought the horse to the house, it's when Connery uses the horse to track her down, and it's very convoluted and really one of the worst pieces of Hitchcock's writing in history, where he basically just uses bullshit to get to a point where he needs to get Connery to where she is. But Connery essentially states that he used her love of this horse to find her. And that places a wedge in the relationship between how she feels about this horse, because now this horse is linked to the end of the life that she'd been living and this new life that she really doesn't want. And then when the horse is killed, it's essentially her killing the past. It's her murdering her sins. It's her cleansing herself of the sins that she's committed by purging herself of this thing that had once represented joy, but also represents all the wrong that she's done in the world. And that is really a great piece of subtle filmmaking, because it's never stated by anyone that the horse means that, but it does if you really think about it.
No, that makes a ton of sense. You just got rid of the rape and repressed memories. Because really, all that makes it redundant, you know, by having that stuff in there.
I mean, really, if it was a movie just about a woman and her horse, you got something here.
There was a movie. It was a documentary about some lady in Dixon who did very similar things.
Oh, man.
Yeah, skip this one. There's enough Hitchcock movies that you'll enjoy. And back when rape wasn't so bad, maybe this was better. But damn kids ruin everything. Oh, man. It's just disappointing. But We all have our bad days. Speaking of bad days, 1990, Child's Play 2, and I don't even, you go ahead, I'm torn. This is a horror movie for kids, a rated R movie for like 7 year olds. That's, and if that's what it is, it's fantastic. It knocks it out of the park. But for anybody above that age, there's too many questions, which I don't know.
Child's Play 2 brings back some of the original cast of Child's Play. Alex Vincent is Andy, and Brad Dourif, obviously, is the voice of Chucky. Chucky still wants to get back in to a body. Specifically, he has to get back into Andy's body. And he somehow survived what happened, the burning, being burned alive in the first movie. His eye, I guess, contains his evil. and the company is trying to cover up what happened, so they rebuild this version of Chucky specifically to show, see, there's nothing wrong with it. Well, there's a whole lot wrong with it because it starts immediately starting to kill people and then sets about trying to find Andy and reenact the legend that it wanted to enact in the first movie, taking over Andy's body. Standing in his way, Christina Lease plays Kyle, who's Andy's now adopted sister. And Garrett Graham, who plays Phil in this movie, I hate this guy and everything that he does. Either it makes him a really good actor or just a really, just he's got that face you just hate automatically. Oh, man. He plays
something for him. It says something that he keeps taking these roles, though, because he just knows he has one of those faces. At least he's aware.
He must know. Yeah. I'm going to have to play a villain every single time. there's nothing to enjoy about this. This is a terrible movie. It's bad from beginning to end. The convoluted idea of how he survives, the convoluted notion of how he continues to keep getting up, and that awful closing sequence where nobody ever kills Chucky. He never can just be killed. It's always got to be he's got to figure out a way to survive this or that. His legs got cut off, but he's still alive. He's been covered in this, but he's still alive.
There's literally scenes where I'm like, well, how are they going to do Child's Play 3? But then he wasn't even dead in Child's Play 2. So it was like, they'll figure it out. I remember when we did Child's Play, Josh's main hang-up was, well, it's just a doll. You just throw it away.
Right?
But at times, this doll's really heavy and can break through windshields. So it's... But
it
then
is
other,
very confusing.
Other times, the kid can just drag the doll around like it's nothing. Like it's a doll. So yeah. A little consistency there would have been nice. At the same time, you know, if I'm 7, this scares the fuck out of me. So I don't, you know, but why would you make rated R movie for 7-year-olds? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe if I'm a teenager, it's fun, but there's no boobs or anything in it. So I don't even know what a teenager is going to get out of this in 1990. Another part was like rewriting the movie and saying, okay, well, Child's Play exists. You can't make that good, but it exists. Now just make the kid crazy. Like, he's making up Chucky, and Chucky's not even in the movie. Do something scary there. You could actually make a decent horror movie out of a sequel of a shitty movie. But obviously, that would just piss people off because there was no Chucky, so why do that? It sucks. It's on HBO if you want to watch it, but it's not very good.
Movie. I don't know if you know that. $13 million budget. It made $35 million back in 1990. It was a monster.
I remember seeing it as like a 7-year-old. Not actually. I didn't get to watch all of it.
Yeah.
But we had moved from one town to another, like half an hour away. We came back to visit old friends, and my parents were upstairs with their parents. We were in the basement. And they had HBO and it was on, and we would watch like 5 minutes of it and then turn it because we got scared, and we put it on again for 5 minutes and then turn it off because it got scared. And that was my first introduction to horror movies. But even that nostalgia could not make me enjoy this experience.
not to give myself too much credit as a child, but when this came out, I was 14 years old, and a friend of mine says, "Let's go see Child Play 2." And I said, "I'm not going to go see the stupid doll movie."
I was only 9. But I hadn't seen any horror movies at that point either. The first one I ever watched, beginning to end, was a few years later. It was Friday the 13th. And we kept waiting for Jason to come on screen. it wasn't even fun enough, Chucky.
All the kills are really boring. Like,
he's a doll. What can he do?
Yeah. And that whole closing sequence is just, it's mind-numbing. The number of times that they just continue to just prolong this movie to try and get it to a feature-length running time is just irritating. Yeah. Just a sad side note, and this is quite sad, and I don't want to, I know I shouldn't bring this to this, but the director of the movie, John Lafia, took his own life earlier this year, and that is very unfortunate and very sad. And he was still working. He wrote the remake of Child's Play, and it seemed like things were beginning to turn around for him maybe a little bit. And it's just a shame that this happened. And just want to say to him, to his family, that as much as we're bagging on his movie, but it's terribly sad what happened to him, and our thoughts are with you.
Oh, absolutely. It's we know movies are never one person's fault, especially something this big, you know. And in some ways, I'm sure it was fun in 1990 for certain people, and it accomplished what he was going for.
I agree with that.
Did you watch The Craze by chance?
I don't know what The Craze is. I'm sorry.
I don't really either.
Let me pull up the premise, and I'm going to try and guess what the movie is.
All right.
let's have a little fun with this.
Let's see here.
Once you have the premise of the movie, I will guess what the premise is. I've not looked this up.
All right, so you want me to read the IMDb premise?
Yeah, okay. But let me guess what it is first. So I think the premise of this movie is set in the 1950s. It's about teenagers and dancing.
This fact-based movie follows the life of twin crime lords in London's 1960s underworld. They're not horribly off.
I was thinking Dance Craze.
We need to do this more often. We should have done this earlier in the year before the good movies started coming out. Because next week, I can't really do that with you. All right, Sean, what's Home Alone about? Okay, Rescuers Down Under.
No, everybody knows what Rescuers Down Under is about.
Okay, Rocky V.
Rocky V, in which Rocky fights a robot.
That's 4.5. I actually watched 10 minutes of Rocky V between movies this weekend just so I could say I tried a little bit. But yeah, that is next week's show. Those are the 1990 movies, Home Alone, Rocky V, The Rescuers, Down Under. Our classic is Dirty Harry, but I'll tell you why in a second. We're going to watch Ammonite, Antebellum, Survival Skills. Is that what it is?
Yes.
And then possibly a movie called Come Away and Chick Fight, depending on their availability and our time. And maybe even something else, depending on what pops up. But Dirty Harry is the classic because of Surviving Skills, which is a parody. Survival Skills. I wrote it down wrong. Sorry.
Survival Skills is a movie that's very difficult to describe. I've got a review that's going up on our Facebook page soon, and you'll be able to check that out there. It doesn't have any spoilers in it, but it's a movie that takes the form of a parody of a documentary about a parody of a police training video, and it's based loosely off of a 1980s police training video that's become infamous on the internet, that people have been watching and kind of both poking fun at and also being totally grossed out by. And so if you somebody who wants to go down that road, there's a documentary, it's a police training video called Surviving Edged Weapons. And it's become infamous just in recent years from people realizing, holy shit, this is how you train police officers.
Yeah. Is it? I haven't. Have you seen it all the way through?
I kind of skimmed it because it is very graphic in terms of the presentation of knife wounds. It's very graphic. So I skimmed it just to look for the most graphic elements, of course. The rest of it is pretty boring of just cops reenact telling stories about, you know, coming head face to face with edged weapons and injuries they had from them, and then these really terribly acted reenactments of some cases, which are very funny. And really, that's kind of the fun part of the Surviving Edged Weapons, is these really awful reenactments.
But it's an hour and a half long. I started watching it very, very briefly, and thinking it was going to be kind of like, you know, in high school when the drama club puts on a drunk driving skits before prom. That's kind of what I thought I was going to get into, and maybe it goes there. I don't know. I'll have to skim through it myself. But is survival skills available to everybody yet? Or
it will be on Friday, I believe. Or actually, it might be tomorrow. Actually, it might be available. I'll post a note on the Facebook and Twitter to kind of give people a heads up on the availability.
And Antebellum has been out for a while at, like, what, $20 or something like that? Or wasn't it Apple TV
just
at one
now
point?
Moving to a more reasonable price this week.
So we're going to talk about that one, too, if you guys want to go check that one out. That looks fantastic. I hope it is. I don't know how it's been doing, but that is our show. Head over to patreon.com/criticspod, help support the podcast. We have our TeePublic page at ihatecritics.net, and if you want to rate and review the show, we'll read your reviews on the air, and I'll try to keep a better eye on the YouTube comments. Maybe we'll read some of those on the air as well. Hold on one second. I want to see if I can find the... if I start playing a video, I apologize. the one comment I have seen is from Sebastian N. He posted it 3 months ago. This podcast was great. Laughed my ass off. So that was... Thank you, Sebastian.
Very cool.
Anyway, let's go to Flickchart and ask you if you like Finding Nemo or The Rundown better.
Finding Nemo.
I agree. Looking for my quarter. Oh, there it is. Or your quarter, really. Oh, and the internet still hasn't loaded. Knowing or Bad Santa?
Not a fan of either. Bad Santa.
I agree. I like it more than you, but at the same time, I am kind of annoyed at the crowd behind Bad Santa. Not as annoyed as I am at the Knowing crowd. Sorry, Josh. Man, my internet's not being fun today. Mm. Although we've had no issues for like the first time in forever. Let's see here. Let's see what this button does. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, Requiem for a Dream.
Whew, wow. I'm never going to watch it again, but Requiem is a better movie.
Agreed. Predators 2010, In the Line of Fire.
I really like Predators.
All right. Moana 21.
Moana.
Agreed. Changeling 2008, Batman Forever.
I always forget which one Batman Forever is.
Val Kilmer, Tommy Lee Jones.
And what was the other option?
Changeling, Angelina Jolie movie.
Changeling is actually not a bad movie.
I agree. And I'm annoyed that Batman Forever cast Tommy Lee Jones and didn't let Billy Dee Williams stay on as Harvey Dent. Not that I'm a big Billy Dee Williams fan, but I mean, that's why he was Harvey Dent to begin with. So someday he could be Two-Face, and he never got that chance. Mm. Run, Lola, Run, I Heart Huckabees.
Ooh, good one. Two really good movies, but it's Huckabees for me.
Agreed. Splash, Spider-Man 2, 2004.
Oh, Spider-Man 2.
Yep. Cocoon, The Great Escape, 1963.
The Great Escape. I don't understand what this... There are a lot of people who say that they like Cocoon, and I've never really gotten what that's about. I don't necessarily... I don't find it adorable the way a lot of people do.
Did we like The Great Escape when we had it as a classic? I can't remember.
If I recall, well, I don't recall, honestly. I liked enough of it, I think.
Oh, yeah, we definitely like it more than Cocoon. I'm not going to argue that point. But I feel like we were disappointed, but it's been a while. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Oh, man, this is a weird one. Sleepers, The Fault in Our Stars.
Jesus, what the hell? I mean, it's two not great movies. How do you choose which one? I guess I would watch Sleepers instead of The Fault in Our Stars.
And that was a movie I was trying to think of a couple weeks back when we talked about the Disney Plus movie. The Fault in Our Stars popped up as the next movie they recommended. What was that movie on? God, I can't remember movies anymore. That with that song the kids sang.
Clouds.
Clouds. Yeah. Way better than A Fault in Our Stars.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine and about something that I wrote years ago about A Walk to Remember. We were talking about what I used to call them dead ingenue movies, and I didn't say it because Clouds is actually a true story, but that it does fall kind of into that dead ingenue movie trope of the pretty person who dies pretty.
Yeah, but there's something about it. I mean, the fact that it's true is probably what it is, but you're right. It like holds itself just above that, the level above the other ones that... But I mean, I thought it. I just never said it. Scream, PCU.
PCU. I love PCU. I know Scream is a classic, but PCU is a nostalgia piece for me. I'll stick by that. I think that movie's hilarious. It probably doesn't hold up today, but there are so many jokes in that movie that I still talk to my sister about today. We still, anytime somebody's going to a concert and they're wearing the t-shirt of the band they're going to see, I always point it out. Don't be that guy.
I always hated that movie for that line. So fucking dumb. I'm going to Scream. I mean,
flip the coin.
You win the coin toss like always. The Terminator. Onibaba, 1964.
Not familiar with it.
Looks like a foreign film. The Terminator Glory.
I mean, I'm going to watch The Terminator, so.
Yeah.
I'm never going to see Glory again.
No. We saw it last year, now we're done.
Yeah.
101 Dalmatians, 16 Candles, the adult.
16 Candles.
Van Helsing, Super Troopers.
I hate both of those movies a lot. Fuck. Super Troopers, I guess I would watch that rather than suffer Van Helsing again.
I think they at least accomplished what they were going for. I just don't like what they're going for. Eraser, The Abyss.
The Abyss. The Eraser's hard to watch.
Yeah, although I don't really like The Abyss either.
No, I don't either.
And I remember Josh being really heartbroken that it kind of sucked when he came back
for it. The best part of that episode?
It's the best part of my life in some ways.